Minnesota Court of Appeals is reconvened. The Honorable Lucinda Justin presiding.
You may be seated. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on this lovely day on July 11th, 2019. I'm here with my colleagues, Judge Renee Warkey and Judge Diane Bradfault, and we have six matters on our calendar today. We've heard three, and now we will be hearing the final three. Marshall, will you call the first case?
This is file number A-19474, Shakira Ali Aiden versus State of Minnesota.
Counsel, let me first ask, since the two of you at counsel table, are you dividing your time?
No, we're not, Your Honor. Okay. I will be doing the whole time.
Yes. Okay, well, each of you will get 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll get an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. When you come to the podium, please introduce yourself, because we are recording this, and that way it'll make it clear to those who listen who is speaking. So whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Abdul Wahid Asman, spelled as A-B-D-U-L-W-A-H-I-D. Last name is spelled as Asman, O-S-M-A-N. I am the attorney for the appellant.
You may proceed.
Your Honors, what a difference a day makes. We are here today because my client, the appellant, suffered a grave injustice as a result of failure by his defense counsel to provide him with the constitutionally mandated effective assistance accorded to every non-citizen criminal convict. The difference that day made now puts my client on course to be deported to Somalia, a country that he fled more than 27 years ago. And the way that day has made difference for my client, Your Honor, is that his defense counsel, Mr. Grant Sanders, failed to advise him that if he were to plead guilty to a gross misdemeanor with a sentence of 365 days...
Without indicating whether or not that has merit, do you agree that if the petition for post-conviction relief was not filed in a timely manner, we don't even get to that? And I'm going to ask that you focus your argument on that, because it seems to me we'll spend a lot of time talking about the effectiveness of counsel when first we have to decide, did your client wait too long?
Thank you, Your Honor. My client did not wait too long. There is an exception, two-year exception, that is part of the standard required for bringing a post-conviction relief petition. My client's status and facts in this case falls within the interest of justice exception under the in Minnesota law, because we believe, Your Honor, that the claim that gave rise to the petition that my client brought in 2019 arose when he became aware of his deportability, and that was in 2019. Even though the conviction occurred in 2012, the respondent would have you believe that was the time that the entire injustice on which this petition is based occurred, and that's not correct. In fact, the judge, the post-conviction court made an error. In finding that occurred in 2016. In fact, we hold the position, Your Honors, that it's true to some extent that the post-conviction court said the client's post-conviction relief, he became aware of, objectively aware of the of his claim of his of the deportability when the United States started deporting Somalis back to Somalia in 2016. That much is correct, but where the court made the mistake is that we disagree that my client became aware in 2016 because he was relying on the affirmative misadvice, and that's different than someone who was told by his defense counsel that he is going to be deported if he were to accept the 365-day sentence.
But does that not mean, is that not the same as what you're asking in your petition, to allow him to have his plea withdrawn because his counsel didn't advise him of the consequences of deportation?
I'm asking Your Honor, the appellant is asking that, Your Honor, that his conviction be withdrawn and his conviction be vacated because he was not accorded his constitutional right to be aware of the consequences of that plea. And that was the direct failure of the defense counsel as well as the presiding judge who did not comply with Rule 15, because Rule 15 requires that in case the defense counsel fails to properly advise about the consequences of the deportation, that the court should in fact give that advisal. And in this case, the record shows, and we have undisputed record, it is one testimony from the appellant as saying that he was told and informed off the record by his defense counsel that he will face no deportation consequences as a result of this plea deal. Not only that, when they came on record, the defense counsel again failed, and the transcript is very clear. In no way does the mandatory language that says under Bedia as well as under Rule 15, that language is a mandatory language. It says that a non-citizen person who is taking such a plea has to be told that he will face deportation, exclusion from admission to the United States, as well as a denial of citizenship. None of that occurred. So my client's claim arose when he was served with NTA, the notice to appear, the charging document, but the only reason it arose is because my client could not have been aware, could not objectively have been aware that he will be subject to deportation because he was detrimentally relying on the affirmative misadvice. And that, Your Honors, is different than if a client is advised you will be deported to that country if you take this deal. Or if the court fails, or if the court advises that person. But in this case, my client was told you will be safe. You will have no issues, no immigration issues, and the record reflects that. And how would he know objectively that he would be deported back to Somalia, even if the government of the United States started to deport people back to Somalia? Under objective standard, my client could not have been aware that even in 2016, when the record shows that the United States government started deporting Somalia, he could not objectively have been aware. And that awareness the reason he could not have been aware of is because he was objectively relying on the affirmative misadvice from his attorney. And Your Honor, therefore, my client, the injustice that my client is basing on his plea, on his petition, is not the fact that the conviction, the same issues, the ineffective assistance issues, occurred in 2012, but because that injustice continues. He is suffering immigration consequences. He has detrimentally relied. He will be on the affirmative misadvice of his defense counsel. He will be deported back to a country that he has been away from for 27 years. He will be separated from his daughter that he's likely will never see, who is an 8-year-old here. That injustice did not occur. While it partially occurred back in 2012, it continues to this day. And I do not know as a counsel any injustice far grave and bigger and continuous than the one that my client, who's today sitting in an immigration detention, facing deportation because his attorney failed to either do the proper research for 15 minutes or maybe less, or make a phone call to an immigration attorney to get an advice of the difference between 365 days and 364 days. And the tragic part is the conviction would have remained the same. I would bet that the county attorney probably would have agreed to the 364 days because the sentence was stayed. So it would not have made any much difference to the county attorney, but for the failure of his counsel. I think my client would have walked away from that proceedings, safe from deportation, by taking 364-day sentence instead of 365 days. And the court did not ask whether he will face deportation or the court failed to comply with Rule 15. Your Honors, the facts in this case are different than the regular, normal boss conviction Badia cases, in the sense that my client, as the record indicates, was affirmatively misadvised about this. He was told that he will be safe from that. And the court of the boss conviction court ignored that fact, which is part of the record. It ignored it because it held that my client should have known objectively back in 2016 when the U.S. government started deporting people. And again, that's also in direct contradiction with the respondent's argument, because respondent actually argues that the basis, the injustice, occurred back in 2012 at the time of the conviction. But the court actually said it occurred in 2016 because that's when Somalia started the deportations. So the my client's claim is not identical. And the respondent would lead you to believe that under Sanchez, if the new basis for the petition is identical to the substance of the boss conviction relief, if the basis for the new the cause of action is different, is identical, then Sanchez is very clear. The reality is the injustice that my client is basing on his claim is not only the ineffective assistance, which occurred in 2012, but it in fact continues to occur. And it's happening as we speak, and it is injustice that far transcended the occurrences or the failure, the ineffective assistance in 2012. Your Honors, my client's case is based on the fact that he not only received ineffective assistance of counsel, but that the court as well failed the presiding judge, who incidentally happens to be the same judge that presided over the boss conviction, also failed to comply with Rule 15. It's very clear from the transcript. There is no mentioning. The language is mandatory. Even if his attorney failed, the court should have accorded him that. And that ineffective assistance is, Your Honors, different than the other injustice which he continues to suffer. And objectively, he does not fall into the new or should have known objective standard. He could not have known because he was detrimentally relying on an affirmative misadvice. That's different than someone who was told you would be deported if you take this deal, or someone that has been advised under Rule 15. In my client's case, he was told you will not face any deportation. And he objectively relied on that. And that's where I would like the court to know that the post-conviction court made erroneous finding when it did not consider that record. The undisputed record is one testimony.
So how is that undisputed? I thought there was a question, and as far as affirmative relying, I mean, I understand your argument, mm-hmm. but I'm just looking at the exchange. I believe it was at the 2000 plea hearing. The question, and you understand that a plea to this charge could have the potential to affect your immigration status. Do you understand that? I understand that is not, you know, meeting some of the standards that you've addressed, but given that he's been told this has the potential to impact your your immigration status, how can you say, well, he affirmatively was relying upon something different that he was told? I mean, so he's told two separate things.
Thank you, Your Honor. That, actually, that statement, that general, broad, fake warning is insufficient under Padilla as well as under Rule 15. Padilla says that if you, if the respondent would believe you that, if the consequences are not truly clear, then the defense counsel could only give general warning. But there is nothing far from the truth in this case, because my client was charged with and was pleading guilty to a crime of violence, which is a domestic violence, and a crime of taking sentence of 365 days. This very court, in the case of Ali v. State of Minnesota, did say that a client who takes a plea deal that is of crime stemming from a crime of violence and with a sentence of 365 days, this very court in Ali versus State said that is very clear. And if it is, because it's very clear to the defense counsel that the consequences are so great, the defense counsel has an obligation to be specific and use the language of deportation, exclusion from admission, and denial of naturalization. So it did, that language, that exchange, which is clear from the transcript, fails under that standard, under Padilla. It also fails that because the consequence was very clear. It was truly clear. It should have been also true or clear to a combatant.
You can finish your sentence.
Thank you. I am therefore asking, based on the record, that the appellant's petition be accepted and that this court withdraws the guilty plea and vacate the conviction. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, Terrence Swihart, Assistant Rice County Attorney on behalf of respondent. The issue in this case is one of timeliness and whether the district court appropriately and summarily denied petitioner's request for post-conviction relief. There's no doubt that the petition for post-conviction relief was beyond the two-year requirement as required within 590.01 subdivision 4A. Therefore, the only ability by which the petitioner is able or the appellant was able to obtain any type of relief was through an exception. In this case, the exception was the interest of justice exception under 590.01 4B5. And within that statute, it requires that the appellant show that at the district court level that the petition was not frivolous, which the district court also found that it was not frivolous. And I don't think there's any dispute that there's no frivolous nature of that petition. But however, that the petition must also be in the interest of justice. But before, and as Judge Werke has indicated, a threshold matter before the district court needs to, is required at least to meet, to address the merits of petitioner's request is whether this petition is timely under 590.014C, which requires that the petition under an exclusion be brought within 2 years in which the claim arises. And when the district court, and this court as well, determines whether that claim, the petitioner has met that two-year requirement, it looks at when the claim arises and then looks, determining when the claim arises, determining when the petitioner or the appellant knew or should have known when that claim arose. In this case, the district court, I believe, implicitly found two areas in which the appellant knew or should have known. One was the 2016, October 2016 admission, excuse me, by a petitioner that the U.S. government was deporting to Somalia effective October 2016, but was not, I think, mass deportations until 2017. The district court relied on that admission and said that even if the appellant didn't know or should have known at the time he pled guilty on August 2012, even if that didn't apply, the October 2016 certainly he would have known or should have known that he was subject to deportation at that time because of the admission that deportations were occurring. And as a result, the petition was not brought within 2 years of that.
If I could just ask a point to clarify, counsel, I think you're referring to the district court's analysis on the, I guess it's page 4.
Yes.
Of the memorandum. And the sentence I noted was petitioner agrees that by October 2016, more than 2 years after filing his petition, deportations to Somalia were occurring.
So right.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
And what's the source for that agreement?
I think that it was the admission within the exhibits attached to the petition.
That's what I thought. Okay.
But my argument, Your Honors, is that actually the district court's reliance on the August 2012 date is where effectively the petitioner should know or should have known that in fact his plea did have immigration consequences, would have led to deportation. That's the date that I think is appropriate that he knew or should have known in this case.
As I understand your opponent's argument, he is asking the court to look at the exchange at the guilty plea hearing and note that it doesn't satisfy Padilla standards, and therefore an acknowledgement by the defendant, Mr. Aiden, in this case, that he understood there were immigration consequences isn't enough to show an objective awareness of the deportation that followed.
I think that goes to the merits of his case with respect to ineffective assistance of counsel.
But how would we ever get to the merits of the case? Judge Long didn't address that. She dismissed it as untimely.
Right. And I think in this case, it was a credibility determination based from Judge Long, because the petitioner submitted an affidavit, or I think a declaration is what he referred to it as, stating that Mr. Sanders, prior to the hearing, didn't advise me of anything that no immigration consequences. Yet on the record, Mr. Sanders specifically says, this may have immigration consequences. So, I think
whether or not that happened, we can't set aside his petition. That needs to go back to Judge Long. Would you agree with that?
She never analyzed
that, did she?
No, she didn't analyze that. But she didn't analyze that because she held that the petition was untimely, and as a result,
right.
There was
but
no
in this case, appellant, at least I interpreted appellant's request of this court is to allow him to withdraw his plea. Versus sending it back to Judge Long to have a hearing on whether or not the ineffective assistance of counsel matter did happen or not, and whether that affected his decision. There was a question there. I don't remember what it was. I guess the question is, what kind of relief do you think that this court is empowered to do if we think that the petition was timely filed, if we disagree with you and we think it was timely filed?
Then you reverse and remand to the district court to make a determination based on to hold an evidentiary hearing, is what I think the relief is to hold an evidentiary hearing to determine, in fact, was then you reach the merits of the case of that petition. Was Padilla violated, or was Padilla not complied with? Was there ineffective assistance of counsel of Mr. Sanders?
But not this court. We don't make that decision.
No. I think this court merely looks at the standard of review here is whether the district court abuses discretion in making that determination that the petition was not timely. And when it applied the new or should have known standard, the standard that this court applies when reviewing that is whether that was clearly erroneous. And in this case, I don't think that the district court's determination that he knew or should have known in October 2012 was clearly erroneous. You have Mr. Sanders at that point, at least on the record, saying this could affect your immigration consequences. This could have immigration consequences. And then 2 years after that, at least the appellant did not engage in any type of activity to determine whether, in fact, that guilty plea would have led to immigration consequences. Instead, he waited until January 2019 when he got the notice to appear. And appellant places a great deal of emphasis on the fact that the notice to appear is the triggering factor. But again, Sanchez v. State, clearly says that it's not a subjective standard. It's not when you found out. It's an objective standard. And in this case, I believe that objective standard applies back to 2012. And I think, although unpublished decisions, I certainly think that the decision cited by the appellant in this case is supporting his position reflect and support the district court's determination. For example, Nagasa, in which he was not represented, and this court there found that his claim actually arose, and it's actually similar facts in this one, where it was, which Nagasa is saying, it shouldn't have been a 365-day sentence. It should have been a 364-day sentence, because by 365, it was a felony, and therefore I was deportable. This court, even though he was not represented, held that his claim, he knew or should have known that his claim arose when his guilty plea was entered in April 2008. And there he specifically held, argued that he did not know, similar to appellant here, of any immigration consequences until he got that notice to appear. And the court dismissed that and said, it's not a subjective, it's an objective. It's not what you find out. And similarly, in Tangen versus B State, again cited by appellant, that case was one in which the district court, in which appellant argues here, the district court didn't go through that rule, those Rule 15 requirements. And even in that case, the court held that even though the guilty plea was not valid because the district court didn't go through those,
Can I just take you back to something more fundamental? I just am troubled by the suggestion that the statement about this may have immigration consequences, which doesn't meet the Bedillo standards, correct? You agree with that?
Well, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, because I think in my brief, I say that Padilla indicates that, as it did in Herrera-Sanchez, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that one, and it's in Padilla, affirmed that when the immigration consequences are truly clear, that then the advice must equally be truly clear. So, for example, murder. Yes, you will be deported. But in those instances in which the crime or the conviction is not truly clear, at least in Herrera-Sanchez, the Supreme Court said the duty of the defense counsel is to provide a general warning of the immigration consequences may be affected. So, well, now he's being deported. At the time, I don't know if that crime would have been one in which he would automatically have been deported. So I think in the case of Mr. Sanders providing a general warning that this may affect your immigration consequences, while not specifically saying you may be deported, but status may be affected, I think that does perhaps satisfy Padilla. Going back to, to wrap up the Tangen cases, in that case, the court found that even though the district court under Rule 15 did not provide that required immigration inquiry, and the court found that the guilty plea was not valid, it still found that the appellant still must meet that two-year requirement. And in that case, the court held that even though his guilty plea was not intelligent and has substantive merit, the appellant cannot meet the exception to the two-year time bar.
But isn't this case different in that here we have kind of the appellant saying, I was affirmatively told there would not be immigration consequences, or words to that effect?
Not on the record, Your Honor. They're on the record, it specifically says.
I understand that.
Yeah. So there is an allegation or claim by appellant that was not, that he was misinformed, if you will, prior to the hearing off the record. I think, again, going back to my argument, is the district court had all the pleadings before it, the record and the affidavit or declaration of the appellant, and made a credibility determination that the record would support, on the record before the court, and the affirmation from the appellant that he understood that. So there may be, there is this allegation that there's some misinformation, but again, on the record, Mr. Sanders says this might happen, or there may be consequences. Do you understand that? Yes, I do. So I think that's more persuasive than there is an off-the-record statement.
From my perspective, and I'd happy to get your reaction to this, I'm more troubled by an off-the-record statement where the on-the-record statement doesn't very clearly meet the Padilla standards. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was suggesting was perhaps different.
I understand. And again, going back to that Padilla standard, that really goes to the merits of the case of whether did Mr. Sanders meet the Padilla standard and if he provided ineffective assistance.
But also, shouldn't we consider that when we're looking at whether he knew or should have known, which you were saying he knew or should have known in 2012?
I don't know if you rely on that specific statement because you have, again, the cases relied on by by appellant where there is no attorney involved and there's no advisory of any immigration consequences, and you have this court saying the new or should have known standard still applies, goes back to that date in which you pled guilty or when the invalid guilty plea was entered, there was no immigration warning. You have, I guess in Nagasa, you had the district court providing a general warning of, I think it was the possibility of probation affecting immigration matters. So you have these, at least in one instance, no warning, and another instance, even more vague warning. Yet this court still held that we're applying that new or should have known standard back to the date of the guilty plea. And so the fact that Mr. Sanders provided what you believe to be a less than required warning, immigration warning.
Would you agree it was a less than ideal warning?
Perhaps a less than ideal, but not necessarily. I wouldn't concede that it would that necessarily violates Padilla, because I don't think we get to that point at this stage. I think it's just a threshold matter of did he meet that two-year requirement, and I don't think he did. I don't think. I know he didn't. It's my position that there is no basis here because he did not meet the two-year requirement under 590.01 subdivision 4C.
So, counsel, let me just back up a second. How to say this? So, is this a case where the district court should have conducted an evidentiary hearing to determine when, objectively, Aiden knew or should have known?
I don't think so. I think the court has the ability to summarily deny a post-conviction petition based on the record, if the record conclusively shows.
Here's what I see in some of our Supreme Court case law, which is where there appears to be any kind of conflict in the paper on a post-conviction proceeding. That's when an evidentiary hearing should be conducted so that the district court can make the sort of robust credibility determination that it needs to make. So here we do have the transcript of the guilty plea hearing and the reference to immigration consequences, the acknowledgement made by Mr. Aiden in this case. But we also have the affidavit filed post-conviction, which, again, lays out the affirmative misadvice that Mr. Aiden was given. So,
let me go ahead and answer the question.
If it's clear. Maybe I wasn't clear.
I'm trying to get at whether this is that special case
where perhaps a post-conviction proceeding should have been conducted. Evidentiary hearing.
And I don't think it had, if I may reply, I don't think it was necessary because you had the district court had the necessary documents. You had the statements and the declarations not only from appellant, but appellant's additional sources. Then you had the record. Which contradicted. So I don't know what additional information would have been garnered from an evidentiary hearing. That's me just speculating. But I don't believe that an evidentiary hearing would have garnered any additional information. I believe that the pleadings in this case provided no basis upon which the court could have granted relief because of that two-year requirement. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you. Thank you again, Your Honors. First of all, the appellant asked for an evidentiary hearing in this matter. The reason we have asked for the evidentiary hearing was to make sure that the appellant will show by submitting the evidence necessary to prove that he was not properly advised. The state opposed that, and the post-conviction court agreed with the state. And the reason we were asking is because this is not a case where not only the off-the-record statement shows that, and there's nothing to show because Mr. Sanders agreed with 365 days when he could have agreed with 364 days with absolutely no, with the biggest consequences for my client. That corroborates.
In your filings, though, didn't Mr. Aiden agree that he knew in October 2016 that deportation proceedings had started with Somalian individuals?
He did, but, Your Honor, he did. But that did not make him objectively aware that he will personally be subject to it because he was relying on the affirmative misadvice. He was basically told, you will be okay. You will be fine. You are not going to face any consequences. So even as he, even if he was aware of those and he did accept that he was at the deportations resumed, but that did not mean that he personally felt that he would be subject to that objectively, because he was still relying on the affirmative advice, misadvice, which told him that you will be safe from that. And that is where we are, that the argument is. Even the court agreed that the post-conviction court agreed that the cause of action, that the claim arose in 2016, and not as the respondent argues in 2012. But the court again made an error in not realizing that, but we disagree with the court because we believe that the actual claim arose in 2019 because of the fact that my client could not have objectively be aware that he will personally be subject to the deportation because of the affirmative misadvice. So we ask it for a evidentiary hearing to do that, and the state is the one that objected to it. Your Honor, what essentially the judge is saying, the post-conviction the judge is saying is that that there is enough lack of that there is inadequate that there is not sufficient effective assistance that led her to come to the conclusion that as 2016, my client could have objectively be aware. And the reality, Your Honor, is that the transcript clearly shows that the fake warning that says that, oh, there will be, you may face immigration impact, that is for someone who is facing an aggravated felony under the immigration law. And Mr. Sanders could have known that. Still, he said, maybe immigration impact. That is far from the truth. Not only does it not meet the standard set by Padilla, but the Rule 15 is very clear. And his lack of response to the judge's failure to comply with Rule 15 also again compounds the situation. Your Honors, my client has suffered enormous consequences as a result of the ineffective assistance by Mr. Sanders and the failure by the presiding judge to tell him that you will face deportation. You will be back to Somalia, or in a sense, a country that you fled as a child, a country that he fled as a child, that he will have such an enormous consequences simply because of that one day, that one day. Any competent defense counsel who is discharging his or her duty should have, and this is 2 years after Padilla. Padilla came out in 2010, and this was in 2012. Your Honors, my client is the injustice that forms, that entitles my client to the 2 year interest of justice exception is there based on the continuous injustice that my client is suffering as of today. Not only what occurred in 2012, as the respondent would lead you to believe, or as the judge would argue, 2016. They are all over the place. That is not the reality. And it's not only the subjective knowledge of him being handed the NTA, but he could not have known. And therefore, I'm asking the court to withdraw the petition and vacate the conviction. The guilty plea, I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both very much. Thank you for the argument and the briefing. The matter is taken under advisement, and a decision will be issued within 90 days.
Where should we? Deborah, should we call the next case?
Yes. I thought you were involved.